I stand to you. Lecture number 12. 3rd of November, 1977, at the Bhagwan Shirasni Sai.
The first question. Well, I was brought up as a Catholic, so how come Jesus is a stranger to me? Jesus is always a stranger. It does not matter whether you were brought up as a Catholic or a Protestant or a Hindu or a Mohammedan. The very being of Jesus is a stranger because he is an outsider. He lives on a different plane. He lives in a different dimension. He lives in God. You live in the world. He talks a different language. He talks about things you have not even dreamt about. You cannot trust him. You cannot even understand him. He is incomprehensible. You may have been brought up as a Catholic. That means you have been taught from your childhood things about Jesus. Those are simply words. You have not been introduced to Jesus. Because that introduction is possible only through meditation, not through any kind of teaching, not through the Catholic catechism. It is all rubbish. In fact, rather than helping you to become acquainted with Jesus, it becomes a barrier. You become knowledgeable. You know many things about Jesus without knowing Jesus. The more you know about him, the less you think that you need to know him. You become by and by satisfied. You started feeling that you already know him without knowing him at all. That's what Christian teachings do. And the more you have been taught, the more you become familiar, the more it breeds contempt. So sometimes it happens that one who has not been brought up as a Christian may have fresher eyes to see Jesus because his mind will be uncluttered. He will not know anything. He will look through innocence. He will not have any conditionings. He will look empty. He will approach Jesus without any prejudice, for or against. And you can know Jesus only when you go nude, naked, naked of all beliefs, naked of all prejudices, when you approach him without any preoccupation. When your mind is utterly silent. So in fact, the Catholic upbringing has done just the opposite. All religions are doing that. It is nothing special to Catholic Church. Hindus desire the possibility to know Krishna. Buddhists desire the possibility to know Buddha. Because knowledge becomes more important than knowing. And knowledge is second hand. Only knowing can help. And remember, let me repeat it again, Jesus is a stranger. He may be standing by your side, but he is not there. He is somewhere else. You may be standing in front of Jesus, but you are not there. You are somewhere else. You and Jesus never meet because the planes are so different. You never crisscross. You cannot. Unless you become something like Jesus, there is no possibility. And to become like Jesus needs great meditation, needs great intelligence, not Catholic upbringing, not a Sunday religion, not foolish dogmas and creeds. Great intelligence, sensitivity, awareness. People are fast asleep. Somebody is asleep as a Christian and somebody is asleep as a Hindu. That doesn't matter. Sleep is sleep. A Christian, a Hindu, a Mohammedan, if all these three get too much drunk, there will be any distinction, differentiation between their drunkenness? The Hindu will behave as foolishly as the Mohammedan, and the Mohammedan will behave as stupidly as the Christian. Once they are drunk, they are drunk, and people are asleep. It makes no difference what kind of theology you have used as a pillow for your sleep. Whether the pillow is white or green or blue or red does not matter. Once you fall asleep, you fall asleep. The pillow becomes immaterial. Whether you are sleeping on the Bible, on the Gita, on the Quran, does not make any difference. You are using pillow. Somebody using the Bible as the pillow, somebody else is using Quran as the pillow. And you are snoring over your scriptures. And Jesus and Muhammad and Buddha and Krishna remain strangers. They belong not to this world. That's why Hindus call them avataras. Avatara means one who has come from the beyond, descended from the beyond. Like a ray of light descends into darkness. It comes from the transcendental world, from the world of Turiya, the fourth. Jesus looks like you, but he is not like you. Don't be deceived by the appearance. He is here on the earth and not of it. He moves in the same world, the same marketplace, the same people, rubs soldiers with you, holds your hands, looks into your eyes, but he does not belong to this world. He belongs to the other source. He has risen. He has risen in God. You can also rise. And only by rising, you will be able to understand him, befriend him. Otherwise, he will remain an outsider. Jesus is the lotus. You are still the mud. There cannot be any dialogue between the lotus and the mud, although the lotus is born out of the mud. Although the mud is carrying many more lotuses than have become manifest. Many unmanifest lotuses are there in the mud. But the mud and the lotus are so different, strangers to each other. That is the situation. If you want to understand the lotus, you will have to become a lotus. Only a lotus can have a dialogue with the lotus. Never become a Christian. If you want to become something, become a Christ. Never become a Buddhist. If you want to become something, become a Buddha. Otherwise, you will remain unaware of the reality of Jesus. And because people feel uneasy, because they cannot comprehend Jesus, they create theories. Rather than transforming themselves, they load Jesus with theories. Theories which can help them to make him comprehensible. No theory can make him comprehensible. All theology is false. But only there are two ways. Either you wrap around Jesus theories which you can understand. In that way, you feel that you have understood Jesus. You have understood only your theories that you have wrapped around him. He remains there, absolutely far away, distant. He is not even touched by our theories. You can weave and spin beautiful philosophies around him. That philosophy you will be able to understand. It is woven by you. It is your creation. It is your invention, rather. But Jesus, who is just standing there, hidden behind our philosophies, is still an outsider. In fact, your philosophies, your theories have made him more of an outsider than he was. With those theories, there has come a China wall between you and him. If you are a Christian, you will never understand Jesus. Your very Christianity will be an obstruction, a hindrance. How can you understand Jesus when you are a Christian? Impossible. What does it mean to be a Christian? It means that you have certain ideas about Christ. You are clinging to certain theories. Those theories become more important than Christ himself. Naturally, because you can understand those theories and you cannot understand Christ, so those theories become more and more important. You can discard Jesus. But you cannot discard your theories. That's why there are so many Christianities. The Christianity of the Catholic and the Christianity of the Protestant and the Christianity of many, many other sects. They all go on fighting. They are always at each other's necks. And they are all followers of Jesus. So, where is the conflict? The conflict is not between their Jesuses, because Jesus is one. The conflict is between their theories and the clinging to the theory. They can discard Jesus very easily. Jesus is discarded. But they cannot discard their theory. Their theory is more important. It is their invention. Jesus has become secondary. No, you cannot understand Christ if you are a Christian or a Catholic. You can understand Christ only if you are nobody. I am not saying that you can understand Christ if you are a Hindu. When you are a nobody, when you drop all the curtains and you start moving that reality called Christ, without any preoccupied mind, empty, clean, clear, no smoke around you, just the clarity and the freshness that clarity brings and the vitality that clarity brings, and you start approaching Jesus with no idea who he is, and then there will be a meeting. Only if you are a nobody, you can meet with Christ or Buddha or Krishna. And these are different names of the same state of consciousness. It is the fourth state of consciousness. Theories belong to the third state of consciousness. And Jesus, Buddha, belong to the fourth state of consciousness. You will have to drop many things before you can feel Jesus. The second question. India is such a sacred country, the heart of spiritualism. I don't understand all the crude remarks that they write in magazines about you. Why is India so ignorant in recognizing you? If they recognize me, then I will not be much worth. Because they don't recognize me. That's why I have something important to deliver to you. The recognition is not possible. It has never been possible. Christ was not recognized by the Jews. Buddha was not recognized by the Hindus. How they can recognize me? Recognition comes from the past. And I am here now. Recognition means that I should behave in a pattern that they recognize. If I walk naked, then Digambar Jainas will recognize me. Because they have the idea that an enlightened person walks naked. They cannot recognize me with clothes on. Those clothes are a barrier. Buddhists will recognize me only if I look like Buddha. And I don't look like Buddha. And I'm not sorry that I don't look like Buddha. I'm happy that I look only like me. I don't look like anybody else. If you look like somebody else, you are a carbon copy. Carbon copies can be recognized because they tally with some original. I cannot be recognized because I myself am an original copy. It does not tally with anybody. The Christian will come and he will start thinking in terms of Christ. He will start looking for Christ in me. And he will not find. That is obvious. And the Buddhist starts looking for the Buddha and he cannot find. Because I am me. And my recognition, if you are searching for it in some past pattern structure, it's impossible. You can recognize me only as me, and to see me as me, you will need to become unprejudiced. To be a Hindu is to be prejudiced. To be an Indian is to be prejudiced. So you ask, India is such a sacred country. First, never be befooled by such slogans. No country is sacred. No country has ever been sacred. It is only rarely that one individual in millions becomes sacred. Countries are not sacred. Just because Buddha was in India, India has become sacred. That means because Albert Einstein was born in Germany, so Germany has become mathematical. That means, if some country has produced a great painter, the country has become artistic. That does not mean anything. No country can be artistic because it has given birth to a Picasso. And no country can be a musical country because a visionary is born there, or a Mozart. No country can be sacred because a Buddha or a Mahavira is born there. Jesus is born not in India. Muhammad is born not in India. Zarathustra is born not in India. Lao Tzu is born not in India. Sacred people have been coming to the world in different places. Places have nothing to do with it. Places are just places. Buddha is born, but once in a million. And what about the million fools? And if you judge by a number, then every country is a foolish country because it produces millions of fools and rarely a Buddha. No country is sacred. No geography is sacred. No history is sacred. That quality of sacredness happens only to individuals, because a country has no soul to become holy. A country has no individuality. Only individuals have souls. And meditation happens in a soul, not in a country. And meditation happens into an individuality, not in a collectivity, not in a society. Remember it, although every country tries to prove itself the best in some way or other, it is part of the game of ego. Every country thinks that I am incomparable. You can go to any country. And every country thinks deep inside that it is higher than others, holier than others, moral than others, this and that. This is part of our egoistic mind which is being projected in the name of the country, sometimes in the name of religion. Every religion thinks this is the highest religion there is, my religion. My religion has to be the highest because it is my religion and I am the greatest person in the world. How it can be otherwise? I have heard about a professor of philosophy. He was head of the department of philosophy in the University of Paris. One day he declared that I am the greatest man in the world. His disciples, his students were a little puzzled because he was a poor professor. First he is a professor and then a professor of philosophy. The poorest. They could not believe, but they have hardly been thinking that he is a little eccentric. Otherwise why one should go and study philosophy? He is a little crazy, but that day they thought he has gone completely out of his mind. What he is saying, that he is the greatest man of the world. One student just jokingly stood up and said, "Sir, can you prove it? And we need a proof, and we can expect a proof from a man like you, a logician, a professor. Have you got any proof for your statement?" And the professor said, "Yes, I have brought it." And he has brought a world map. He fixed the world map on the blackboard. They could not understand what he is going to do with the world map. And then by and by they came to understand what he is going to do. First he said, "I will ask one question. Which is the greatest country in the world?" Naturally they were all French. So they said, "France." So he said, "So now the whole world can be dropped, we can concentrate on France. If I can prove that I am the greatest French, then I will be proving that I am the greatest man in the world." Still they were not certain what he is going to do. Then he said, "Which is the greatest city in France. Naturally, it is Paris. And they were all Parisians. Now they started suspecting that he has something in it. And he said, Paris, and I am the greatest man in Paris. If I can prove this, then my first statement will be proved. And then he said, which is the greatest place in the city of Paris? Naturally, it is the university. The seat of learning, the seat of wisdom, knowledge. Now, to everybody it was clear that they are trapped. And then he said, which is the greatest department and the greatest subject in the university? It is philosophy, and they were all students of philosophy. So naturally it is philosophy. And then he said, who is the head of the department of philosophy? I am the greatest man in the world, he said. That's how we go on, vicariously, indirectly proving that we are the greatest. So our country is the sacred country. Our country is the most brave country. Our country is the most intelligent country. Our country is the most aesthetic country. And all kind of things are being claimed. And everybody else is a barbarian, uncivilized. Everybody else is the link between monkey and man. We are man, and everybody else is a link. It is not only Adolf Hitler's logic. It is the logic of everybody. And unless this logic is thrown away to the dogs, Adolf Hitler's will go on coming. They use this logic. They say, our race is the Nordic race, the Aryans, the purest blood. And these are all nonsense statements. What do you mean by pure blood? Everybody's blood is pure. Unless you mix something in it. Everybody's blood is pure. What do you mean by pure blood? And what do you mean by pure race? All races have been mixing. And man has been growing by mixing with each other. And the cross breed is the more stronger breed, because it has more complexity. And the growth is from simple to the complex. What do you mean by calling a race pure? But just egoistic ideas. It appeals. It appeals to people. It gives them a great nourishment for their egos. It becomes food. No country is sacred. Yes, there have been only few and far in between individuals. A Buddha, a Christ, a Zarathustra, a Muhammad. They can be counted on fingers. These are sacred people. But they have been coming to every part and place of the world. They have been coming to every geography. Never be trapped by such slogans. These slogans are dangerous, poisonous. You say India is such a sacred country. It is not, because no country is. And you say the heart of spiritualism, all nonsense. You cannot find more materialistic a country in the world than India. But you will have to look with open eyes. You will be surprised how this idea that India is the heart of spiritualism is not allowing you to see the reality. Just another sannyasin has written that, Bhagwan, I am freaking out that the move to Gujarat is postponed. Why is he freaking out? Because he says in Pune, it is so difficult to walk on the streets. People look at you with such lustful eyes. One feels embarrassed. They come on bikes and motorbikes and hit you. If they can touch the woman's body, they will not lose that opportunity. And they are crude and ugly. And I can understand the sannyasin's letter to me. And you call these people the heart of spiritualism? They are the most sexually obsessed people in the world. Of course, they are against sex. But that does not make them non-sexual. That makes them sex-obsessed. Their whole mind is sex-obsessed. Continuously they are thinking of sex. And they are against it. Because they are against it, they cannot fulfill it. And because they cannot fulfill it, it goes on accumulating and drives them crazy and pervert. Now, this is ugly. If you love a woman, to hold her hand has a beauty. To caress her body has a beauty. But just a woman is walking on the road and you hit her. It is perversion. It is love has gone in a very poisoned and ill state of affairs. It is pathological. It is uncivilized, uncultured. But this goes on happening. And these people are against materialism. But just don't listen to their words. Watch their life and you will find them more materialistic than anybody else. Indians are so much obsessed with money. Money seems to be their god. No other country worships money. In India it is worshipped. They have a special day in the year when they worship notes and rupees. That day is coming closer, Diwali. No country in the world has ever worshipped rupees and money. They worship. And this is not just symbolic. This is very indicative. They cling to money like anything. It is very difficult for them. To be non-greedy. To leave a single paisa is impossible. And that's why if somebody renounces a little bit of money, he is thought to be a great man. That too is materialism. Why? If somebody has renounced money, what is the point in it? Why he should be praised? But he is praised like anything. The whole country will talk about him. He will be thought to be a great man. He has renounced money. Then money must be the greatest value. One becomes great if one renounces money. If people were really spiritual, renouncing money would be somebody has renounced his mistake. That's all. There is nothing great in it. Somebody has found that money is valueless. So he has renounced. But there is nothing to be praised in it. He has corrected his errors. He was thinking 2 and 2 are 5. Now he have come to understand that 2 and 2 are 4. You don't go declaring him that he has become a Buddha, because now he knows 2 and 2 are 4. Before he was stupid, now he is normal. But in India it is worshipped if you renounce money, because the people know how much they are clinging to money. And you call the India the heart of spiritualism? This is what Indians have been teaching to the whole world. Don't be deceived. This is just advertising. They go on claiming all over the world that they are the heart, that they have the greatest secrets of spirituality. And they go on exploiting in the name of spiritualism. And they can deceive people. And they can deceive only because people in the West particularly are no more materialistic. Let me explain it. In the West, there is material affluence. People have much more money, better houses, bigger cars, better bank balances. That is true. But people are not materialistic. They have much material wealth, but that does not mean that they are materialistic. In the East, people are poor, but that doesn't mean that they are spiritualists. Poverty has nothing to do with spiritualism. In fact, you can become aware that material wealth has nothing in it, only when you have it, not before it. Psychologists talk about 3 layers are planes of desires and needs. They call it the hierarchy of needs. First they call the physiological needs. Second the psychological needs. Third the spiritual needs. And this idea of the hierarchy of needs is very, very important. First and the basic needs are physiological. Food, sex, shelter. If food is not available, you cannot think of poetry. If food is not available, you cannot think of music. Music is a higher need. If sex is not available, you cannot think of love. Love is a higher need. It comes only when sex has become very, very satisfied, not before it. When you have food, right shelter, clothes, warmth, and you are not constantly starving yourself and not constantly afraid of tomorrow, that tomorrow is coming and you may be again hungry and you may not get bread and butter, then you start thinking of something else: music, poetry, literature, painting. When sex needs are fulfilled, love arises. It cannot arise if sex needs are not fulfilled. And in India, sex needs are not fulfilled. That's why people are not loving. Notwithstanding what they pretend, people are not loving because their basic need is not fulfilled. They are sexually starved. Because food need is not fulfilled, thousands of people die every year because of starvation. And those who are not dying, they are undernourished. So they cannot have higher needs. They cannot think of beauty. And they cannot think of stars. And they cannot see dewdrops on the grasses in the morning, and they cannot see the sun rising. That is not possible. The body needs to be completely satisfied. When the body is satisfied, it starts moving into new dimensions. It thinks of higher things. It dreams of higher things. The second stage is psychological needs. Love, music, art, painting, poetry, sculpture. If your love need is not fulfilled, then prayer never arises. That is the third, the highest need. Sex fulfilled, love arises. Love fulfilled, prayer arises. When physiological needs are fulfilled, you start singing and dancing. When dance need is fulfilled, then arises the need to meditate. When you have heard the outer music, then you want to hear the inner music. When you have known the poetry that is created by words, then you want to know the poetry that is wordless, the poetry that arises in silence. Those are spiritual needs. And there is no way to jump. What I am talking here is the highest need. So it is not accidental that the people from the West are coming to me and the people of India go on condemning me. It is just natural. I don't take any offense in it. It is natural. It is how it should be. I am talking of the third need, spiritual need. And people in India are not even fulfilling their first need. There is no meeting between me and them. I am a stranger here, an outsider. They need food first. They don't need God at all. God does not make sense. They can't be interested in music. How they can be interested in music? How they can see the beauty of a solitary tree standing in the field all alone? It is impossible. They are preoccupied with their body needs. So whatsoever I say is completely incomprehensible to them. They take revenge. They go on criticizing. In criticizing me, they think they have solved the problem. They are deceiving themselves. They don't want to see the problem. They don't want to see that a country can be spiritual only when it has settled as far as materialism is concerned. Spiritualism is a higher stage of materialism. It is the same search. First you have to seek in matters. Then you have to seek in mind. When you don't find in matter, you start seeking in mind, but the matter has to be searched completely. Only then you can rise to the mind. When you search in the mind and you don't find it, and you have searched the whole realm of the mind, then you start searching in the soul. That's how it is. And because I call a spade, people don't like it. How can they like if I say that India is very sexually obsessed? How they can like? They like Vivekananda because he says you are the greatest country in the world. You are the most spiritual country in the world. You are the source of all spiritualism. you are the source of all wisdom. You are the source which is going to lead the whole world. They feel very good. They can't feel good with me. With Vivekananda they feel good. Vivekananda becomes a hero because he satisfies their egos. And just because he satisfies their egos, I declare that he is not enlightened, because no enlightened person will ever satisfy anybody's ego. Because to satisfy anybody's ego is really inimical. It is poisoning him. I say things as they are. I say it is one of the most barbarous countries. Ugly, materialistic, money-oriented, sex-obsessed. And I don't deny that Buddha had been here. Mahavira had been here. They were spiritual people, but they don't make the whole country spiritual. If I am here, remember it. Someday, after a few centuries, Pune will claim that Pune is spiritual because of me. And I have nothing to do with Pune, and Pune has nothing to do with me. Just the same was the case with Buddha. India had nothing to do with him. He was alone and solitary. And people were as much cruelly criticizing him as they are criticizing me. They have always done that. They were throwing stones at Mahavira. They are throwing stones at me. They have always done that. And not only here, everywhere in the world they have done that. Whenever there is somebody who brings light into the darkness, people feel offended. Because his presence becomes a very, very embarrassing phenomenon. Because he reminds you of your darkness. He reminds you of your ugliness. Have you not heard about the woman who was against mirrors? And whenever she will come across a mirror, she will immediately throw a stone and break it. What is the logic? That mirrors are against me. And whenever I come before a mirror, the mirror shows that I am ugly. She was ugly, but she was very much offended by the mirror because the mirror shows her ugly. She was throwing the responsibility on the mirror. That has always been so. Buddha is a mirror. He reflects whatsoever you are. If you are ugly, he reflects you are ugly. If you are materialistic, he reflects you are materialistic. He simply reflects without changing, without coloring. He simply reflects that which is. Naturally, people feel offended because then their ugliness and all kinds of darknesses and snakes and scorpions moving inside their being, and they all are reflected. They want to throw a stone at the mirror. If the mirror is not there, they will be again at ease. Hence they crucified Jesus and they killed Socrates. This has been their attitude everywhere and always. You ask me, India is such a sacred country, the heart of spiritualism. I don't understand all the crude remarks that they write in magazines about you. They are very, very understandable. Nothing is special about them. If they don't write those crude remarks about me, that will not be right. Lao Tzu has said, when I talk about Tao, very few are there who understand it. Those who understand, they become silent. Many are who feel offended. They become angry. And the angry people are more. And Lao Tzu says, if people don't become angry, then what I am saying is not truth. One mystic used to stay with me. He was really a beautiful old man. Very strange. Very eccentric. But always to the point. He used to deliver talks all over the country. He had something to give. And whenever people will applaud, he will become very angry. He will say, stop. Don't applaud. Because whenever you applaud, I think I must have said something wrong. If you can understand it, then it must be wrong. When you don't understand, only then there is possibility that some truth has been said. And if you become angry, then certainly some truth has been said. Then some stone has been thrown into your sleep and you have become disturbed. Your dreams are disturbed. You are ready to take revenge. Because I am saying the truth, because I am being the truth, it is very natural. I don't understand all the crude remarks that they write in magazines about you. They should be writing more and more. The more people will be coming to me, the more angrier they will become. Because the more dangerous I will be to them. And more people will be coming. They are on the way. And when there will be thousands, many thousands of sannyasins around here, they will become very, very angry. Because then they will become afraid, more afraid, that what I am saying is becoming powerful. They will try everything to destroy what I am saying. They will try in every way to destroy me. That is natural. Nothing is unexpected in it. And you have to be ready for it. You have to be ready to accept all this. You need not feel offended. This is the way they are showing their respect towards me. When they threw stones at Buddha, they were showing their respect. That was their way of recognizing that someone dangerous is present. When they crucified Jesus, that was their respect. Their way of respecting a man who has brought truth to them. When they poisoned Socrates, that was their humble homage. So this is going to happen, and this is going to happen more and more. You have to be accepting of it without any anger. Why is India so ignorant in recognizing you? Because India is very knowledgeable. India thinks it knows already. Every panwala, every chaiwala, they all know what truth is. They can quote Gita and the Vedas. They are like parrots. India is a country of pandits, parrots. They go on repeating mechanically. And because they think they know, how they can recognize me. Because I am saying things which go against their parrot-like knowledge. I go on saying things which are against their so-called knowledge. I am trying to give truth new words, because the old words have become rotten. Because the old words have been used so long, they have lost intensity. They have lost life. They have become like dirty currency notes. When a currency note comes out of the mint, it is fresh, clean. When it moves into hands from one hand to another, it starts becoming dirty. Words are also currency. Currency means they go on moving. They are like a current. From one mouth to another mouth, the word goes on moving down the centuries. It becomes very dirty. Vedas have become dirty. So has become the Bible. I am trying to renew. I am trying to give new words to old truths. New bottles to old wine. They cannot recognize the bottle. They don't know anything about the wine. They have never tasted it. They only know about the old bottle. When they see the new bottle, they become angry. This can't be the truth. The truth has to be in the old bottle. And the old bottle is rotten, maybe broken. And the wine has flown out of it. It may be just empty bottles. And they don't know anything about the wine. They only know about the bottle. So if I give new bottle, they cannot recognize it. Only those who have tasted wine will recognize me. Not otherwise. You will recognize me because you are tasting with me. You are a part of the feast I am. You are celebrating with me. The more you will taste, the more you will know that what I am saying is exactly what Jesus said, or Buddha said, or Krishna said. But first you will have to taste me, then that recognition will come. They are too much occupied with Krishna's words and Buddha's words. Those words are like bottles. And they cannot come here. They are very much scared, frightened. Maybe they have deep down somewhere a suspicion, maybe there is truth, and if they come close, they may be converted. That fear, unconscious fear, is there. They go on talking against me, and they don't know anything about me. They go on writing against me, and they have never come here. They never listen. They never look into my eyes. They never come close. They go on circulating rumors, and they feed upon each other's rumors. It is a mutual arrangement. Somebody writes one article in a magazine, somebody else writes another, bases himself on that article, and this way it goes on and goes on. And of course, then they have much material. And they have been reflecting each other. And nobody comes to me. But that's how they have always been doing. They are afraid to come. In fact, they criticize me just to protect themselves. That criticism helps them. Because of the criticism, they can think that now there is no need. But more and more people will be coming to me, thirsty people, seekers, who have nothing to do with Christianity or Hinduism or Mohammedanism, they will be coming to me. I am here only for the seekers, not for the mob. And what the mob says is irrelevant. I am here only for those who are ready to be transformed and transfigured. And I want only to be for them. I don't want a single minute on anybody else. And these people are there in the world. Many at this moment. Because this moment is very critical in the history of man. In the history of human consciousness. A great jump. Either man dies or man becomes new. That is the only choice. The old man cannot continue. The old man has arranged for its suicide. It is ready to commit global suicide. Either the old mind wins and there will be a global suicide and humanity will disappear from the earth, or the new mind will be born, and that's what is the effort here, and humanity will take a new direction. The new man will be born. The new man will not be Indian, and will not be German, and will not be Chinese. The new man will not be Christian, will not be Hindu, will not be Mohammedan. The new man will not be black, will not be white. The new man will not be man, will not be woman. The new man will be a totally different kind of being, with no adjectives around him, a purity, a primal innocence. My work is to give birth to that new man. And if only few can be transformed, they will become the heralds. Only few seeds, if they can grow into the new man, they will create the new humanity. My whole interest is with them and in them. I want to invest my whole energy into those few people who are ready to slip out of the old system and become new. The Indians cannot recognize me. The Christians cannot recognize me. The Hindus cannot recognize me. To recognize me, they will have to come out of their preoccupations. Two keen football fans up in London for a big match decided to spend the evening at a Soho strip club. The first act was a very voluptuous blonde who went through her routine while the whole audience stared open-mouthed. As the curtain came down and the applause rang out, one of the two fans said, "Fui!" His companion was surprised but said nothing. The second act was even more breathtaking, but again, when the curtain came down, the first man said, "Fui!" This went on all through the show. However beautiful and exotic the girls were, after each act the first man said, "Fui!" Finally the second man could stand it no longer. "What is the matter with you?" he said. "These are some of the most attractive and sexy girls I have ever seen. And all you can say is, 'Fui!'" "I am not thinking about the girls," replied the friend. "I am thinking about my wife." Now this is his preoccupation. He is not looking at those girls. He is thinking of his wife. He is not saying "Fui" to these girls. He is saying flee to his wife again and again. A preoccupied mind never sees that which is confronting, never sees that which is. It goes on comparing. When an Indian comes, he is not listening to what I am saying. He is comparing in his head whether it collaborates with the Vedas, whether it follows Gita. Is it in harmony with this or that? He is continuously working inside his mind, comparing, judging, condemning, criticizing, and he goes on missing. He looks that he is here, he is not here. And it is not only a question of Indians. Anybody who has come with a fixed mind will have the same difficulty. Ramananda's old mother is here. And just the other day somebody said that she went to the mass in the church. Here, Jesus is being made alive. Here we are living Jesus again, moving with Jesus again. Here Jesus is again, not a history, but a presence. But Ramananda's mother had to go to the church, to the mass, to listen to some stupid priest there. The preoccupied mind. My Christ is not her Christ. My Christ is a line. She wants the Christ which is sold in the church. She wants the old bottle. She must have felt good there. Because this must be a strange world to her, these orange people, what they are doing here. There she must have felt good. In the same kind of people. With the same kind of mind. She must have felt relaxed. At home. This is how it happens with the preoccupied mind. The Christian visitor to Jerusalem asked his Israeli host to show him the Wailing Wall. Arriving at the sacred spot, the visitor put on his hat, stood close to the wall and said, "Thank you, Lord, for all the blessings you have bestowed upon me during my life." Then he turned to his Israeli friend and said, "Is that nice?" "That's nice," said the Israeli, smiling. The Christian then turned back to the wall and said, "Please, Lord, keep my family and friends in health and prosperity. Is that nice?" "That's nice." "And persuade," he said, "the Israelis to see the error of their ways and to hand back to the Arab nations the land taken from them in the recent conflicts, so that there may be peace in the Middle East. Is that nice?" And the Israeli said, "You are talking to a wall." The third question. I am very interested in the miracles of Jesus, especially his healings and his resurrection. He has also said that others could do the same. Is this possible? If so, how? And is it necessary for the physical body to die before one learns how to manifest and de-manifest at will? I have rebirther friends who have developed some powers. Teleportation astral double, transforming one's body form and our functions. Is it dangerous for them to be developing these powers before being fully realized? They say it is easy. You just have to believe you can do it. How does one protect oneself from negative group thought forms? For example, don't drink the water or you will get amoebas, or everyone gets sick in Pune. It seems to be true. I had not been sick for 2 years before coming here and had learned to heal myself, yet here I feel the group conscious or unconscious negativity weighing me down. I too am sick and I don't like it very much. What I don't like is feeling the effect of the group mind and unable to maintain my space. Please discuss. It has always seemed to me that beliefs are more contagious than germs or infections. The question is from Ma Prem Mantra. Few things. First, mantra must be very much afraid of death. That's why the interest in resurrection. It has nothing to do with Jesus and his resurrection. It has something to do with your deep fear of death. The interest in the miracles of Jesus, especially his healing and his resurrection. Mantra must be very much afraid of death and illness. Because of that fear, this interest arises. Otherwise, who bothers? If you are not afraid of death, who bothers about resurrection? It is fear. In fact, if it is proved absolutely that there had been no resurrection in Jesus' life, 99% Christians will drop being Christians. Because then what is the point? They have been hanging around this person with the idea that he knows the secret of resurrecting himself, and somehow he will impart his secrets and keys to them. Or maybe if he does not show the art, at least he can do the miracles for them. He can save them. It is fear of death. If it is absolutely proved that Jesus never did any healing miracles, then you will not find many Christians in the world. They will disappear. They are not interested in Jesus at all. Their whole interest is how to protect themselves from illness and finally from death. Mantra, rather than thinking of resurrection and healing miracles, go deep inside yourself and look into your fear of death. There is no resurrection. But if you go deep into your fear of death, it disappears. And with the fear of death, death disappears. Then you know you are eternal life. There is no resurrection. Resurrection is possible only if first you die. You never die. Nobody has ever died. Death is a myth. The word myth comes from a Sanskrit root mithya. Mithya means false. Death is a falsity. Death has never happened, never is going to happen. It cannot happen in the very case. Life is eternal. Only forms change. Here you die, your flame disappears into this body, in some other body, it becomes embodied. In some other womb, you are born. So on, so forth. And even when there is no more birth, you disappear into God. But life lives. And when I am saying life lives, I don't mean mantra lives. No. Mantra is a form. You are a form. The form is not eternal. The form is going down the drain. Even while you are alive, you will change 1,001 times your form. If somebody brings a picture of you, of the first day when you were born, will you be able to recognize that this is your picture? One day that was your form. Now you are 70 years old. You cannot recognize. But even maybe the first day's picture can have some resemblance. But what about when you were in your mother's womb? The first day you entered the mother's womb, if a picture could have been taken, will you be able to recognize that a small cell? It will not have your face. It will not have your nose. It will not have any visible mark. It will be just a small life cell. It was you. Then those 9 months, your form goes on changing, changing, changing. And then your whole life, the form goes on changing. Form is a flux. You never die. Form dies every day. But the problem arises because you have become too much identified with the form. You think I am the form. You think I am this body. Then the fear of death arises. You need not learn the art of resurrection. You have simply to learn that death does not exist. There is no need to resurrect. Because you cannot die in the first place. Rather than being intrigued by Jesus' miracles, do a miracle mantra, go into yourself. That is the only miracle. Go into your fear of death and go on deeper into it and see where it is, what it is. Watch it. And don't rationalize. And don't bring theories borrowed from the outside to console yourself. Don't say that soul is eternal. No. You don't know yet. I am saying it is eternal, but that is not your knowledge. Don't make it your consolation. You have to go trembling. You have to go with fear. You have to descend the staircase of death. You have to go to the very end. You have to see whole possibility of death, what it is. In that very seeing, you will be surprised that you are not it. You are not the body. You are not the mind even. You are just pure life energy. You are a witness. In that witnessing is the real miracle. You say, I am very interested in the miracles of Jesus, especially his healings and his resurrection. You are not interested in Jesus at all. If you are interested in his miracles, healing and resurrection, that is the wrong kind of interest. And because of that, Jesus' religion died very early. It really was a miscarriage. Buddha lives far more penetratingly into human consciousness still, because he never did anything like miracles. So only the people who were really interested into inquiry came to him. Jesus attracted wrong people. Wrong people came around him. And then Christianity made its base on his miracles. And I don't think that he ever did any miracles. He did miracles which are far penetrating, but they are totally different than what you have heard. Yes, he healed the eyes, but not the physical eyes. He healed the inner eyes. Yes, he made people listen who were deaf. But that has nothing to do with your physical deafness. All are deaf and all are blind. And he touched people's eyes and their ears and opened them. And all are dead because you are identified with the body which is death. You are identified with the form which is death. Yes, he helped many people to come out of death. That is the meaning of the story of Lazarus. He called forth Lazarus, come out. On the ordinary plane, it seems he called him from his grave. On the higher plane, it means he called him from his body. Body is your grave. He made him aware that he is consciousness, not the body. That is the real miracle. But somehow, the followers of Jesus got mixed. That's why I say again and again, he was not as fortunate as Buddha, because he didn't get a right kind of following. And much depends on followers. A single wrong follower and can destroy the whole, can change the whole story, can interpret the whole story in a wrong way. When Buddha died, his disciples gathered together to write down whatsoever he has said ever. Now there were millions of his stories, because everybody was relating in his own way. How to decide? And all these people were eyewitnesses. And very cultured people, sophisticated people. And they were saying different things, contradictory to each other. Then it was decided that only those few disciples who have become enlightened in Buddha's days, they should be listened. Even one of the most intimate followers, Ananda, was not allowed, because he has not yet become enlightened. He was the most intimate disciple. He lived with Buddha for 40 years, day in, day out, year in, year out. Not for a single day he was away from Buddha. For 40 years he slept in Buddha's room. He took every care of Buddha. He should be relied upon. Whatsoever he says should be the most authentic, because he had listened to everything that Buddha said in those 40 years. After his enlightenment, not a single word he has missed. And he was very sophisticated, cultured, had a beautiful memory, one of the miraculous memories. He could repeat things word by word, but even he was not allowed. He cried, he wept, he said, "What are you doing? I was the most intimate. You people have lived for a few days with Buddha, somebody has for a few months. I have lived for 40 years. And not only in day, night too." And we had many conversations which nobody has ever heard. "I know much more than anybody else." And they said, "That's true, but you are not enlightened yet. You can be dangerous. Your unenlightened mind can pollute the whole message. You may put something into it, you may delete something out of it, and that will be unconscious, not that you will be doing it. It will happen automatically because of your unconsciousness. And you may emphasize something Because of your unconsciousness, that looks more important, and you may forget something, or may not emphasize something which was more important, or would have been more important if you were enlightened. The emphasis will be different. You will underline different things than an enlightened person. You cannot be allowed. 500 disciples who had become enlightened in Buddha's days, whose enlightenment was declared by Buddha himself, only they were allowed. Buddhist scriptures are the most authentic. And Ananda was sitting outside the door, crying. And after 24 hours, he was allowed. What happened? In those 24 hours, for the first time, the last barrier that has remained in him broke. That was a barrier that has persisted for 42 years. He was a cousin brother to Buddha and an elder cousin brother. When he had come to be initiated by Buddha, he was elder, and in India, traditionally, the elder brother can command the younger brother. So he said to Buddha, "Before I be initiated by you, let me command you three things. I am your elder brother. Once I am initiated, I will be a disciple. Then whatsoever you will say, I will have to follow. But I am not yet your disciple. I am your elder brother. These three things you promise me, then initiate me." Buddha said, "What are those three things?" First, he said, "I will live with you 24 hours. Forever. You will not be able to say that, Ananda, you go somewhere or you do something. I will follow you like a shadow. Promise?" And Buddha promised. Of course, when an elder brother asked such a thing, how can he deny? He said, "Okay, what is your second?" And he said, "Even in the middle of night, I bring somebody inside. You will have to give the appointment. You cannot say no to me. I will have the sole right. Anybody, if I feel needs you, and needs immediately, I will have the sole right. I will decide it." Buddha said, "Okay. And what is your third?" And he said, "My third is that whatsoever I ask, you will have to answer. You cannot postpone. You cannot say later on or after some days. You will have to answer it immediately." Buddha promised these three things. Ananda became his disciple. But that ego remained, that I am the elder brother, that I am the most close, that I am the only one who sleeps in the Buddha's room, that I am the only one who can ask any question and Buddha has to answer, that ego remains. Otherwise, he became surrendered, but that ego remained. When the conference of the monks did not allow him in, it was so painful to him. It was so wounding. It hurt. And he cried and wept outside. And then he became aware that because of my, this is small ego, subtle ego, many more came to Buddha and became enlightened and I didn't become. In that awareness, that ego melted. And you will be surprised. When Ananda became enlightened, the whole conference inside, 500 monks, immediately felt. They said, "Open the doors. Ananda is no more the same person. Bring him in." Jesus was not so fortunate. His disciples were ordinary in a sense. Not a single one was enlightened. So whatsoever they wrote was from the unenlightened standpoint. So the real meanings got lost and unreal meanings got imposed. The miracle of giving eyes to a spiritually blind man became a miracle of giving eyes to a blind man. Healing a person from the illness called this world became an ordinary healing of healing a person from tuberculosis or something like that. Making a person really alive for the first time, and he was dead up to now, became an ordinary miracle of giving life to a dead man. Mantra, don't be interested wrongly. Your interest is wrong. Second, he has also said that others could do the same. In this, is this possible? If so, how? And is it necessary for the physical body to die before one learns how to manifest and de-manifest at will? Will is the source of ego. Let it be understood deeply. All is possible if the will is dissolved into God's will. All is possible with no conditions. But if you want to do it at will, then you will become more and more egoistic. And that's what happens. People who can do few things which are not of any significance become very egoistic because they can do them. All these so-called siddhis and miraculous powers just enhance your ego and are against spiritual growth. Beware of it.